Everybody, welcome to the Green Architects Lounge podcast. I'm your host, Chris Briley.
And I'm your host, Phil Kaplan. Chris.
Phil.
You know, we've been here the whole time.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to press record.
Chris and I had actually recorded a whole bunch of these, and they just
just didn't show up. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, we're sorry that it's taken this long for us to come back.
Again, this is not our day job. We are architects. Green architects, one would even say.
But man, have we learned so much, Chris, since our last podcast?
Oh yeah,
this one's going to be killer.
I'm sure it is. Buckle up, people, because
strap in. We're talking about foundation details.
That's right. That's right. So this is all about how you're. You know, it's literally the foundation of your building project. That's awful.
So, yeah, that
but
was.
It is arguably the most.
I can do a click and clack.
It's lame.
So is my brother.
don't draft like my brother. So we're going to be talking about frost protected slabs, basements, crawl spaces, and you know, just some of the details we're doing, because we realized talking to some colleagues, you know, there's a lot to talk about when we. You know, I found myself having a very interesting conversation. You know, we don't get into that a lot, you know, these details where you're talking to colleagues. It's like, how did you do that frost-protected slab? And then you have that conversation, and like, well, I don't do it that way. Well, how do you do it? And then you realize, wow, there's a few ways to do this out there.
There are, and you know what? I think we've both seen some real innovation.
Yeah, a lot's happened lately, I think.
Because it feels like we've been doing the same thing for years and years and years, and then we were barely insulating our foundation walls and slabs.
Oh yeah,
the number of
basement walls out there that have nothing is amazing, and there's still production builders out there right now. I bet you right now someone is pouring an uninsulated foundation. I mean, just, and they're in climate zone 6.
That's
and
right.
They're just pouring a basement wall
because that's the way they've always done it.
It's just a basement.
It's
Phil.
A crime. Oh my god.
Yeah. Don't worry. They'll put some pink stuff in the floor. Maybe
it'll be fine.
It'll be all right.
They'll put some pink stuff under the
house
slab.
House has to breathe. All right. Before we do that, Phil, you're taking charge with this cocktail because you have an ingredient that might be difficult for the layperson to get, but we're going to put a link on the. Tell us about the cocktail.
Yeah, well, there is a local distillery called Main Craft Distilling, run by my friend Luke Davidson, and he's a builder by trade, but he kind of said, wouldn't it be cool to make my own alcohol?
Man, I've had that same idea.
Yeah, you know, you just drink it.
I know, I drink it instead of make it.
You make your own beer, Chris.
Well, I do. If you and if you're a client of ours, you can get a Briburn brew for Christmas.
That's right.
That's what we do for, well, that's what we did do. It was
but
a lot
drink
of work.
It fast.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't, it was a little flat, unfortunately. But anyway.
The packaging was gorgeous, Chris.
Thank you, yeah.
The packaging on Luke's product is really gorgeous as well.
It is. The bottle is perfect.
It is, but the thing that I was really taken by is not the fact that I knew the guy or the fact that it was local, although those things are nice.
Yeah.
It was this particular product, this particular spirit, I guess you would call it.
Yeah, I call it spirit.
It's called a Chisungkook. Botanical spirit is what they call it. And it's made from, right there, Chris.
Carrots.
Made from carrots.
Which is, and that by itself, before we mix it, is just a unique, nice, you know, different spirit. Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, you don't run into that very often.
You don't. And it has a very different flavor.
Right. So it's like vodka. You can make vodka from a root vegetable, like from the starches of a potato, or you can make it from a carrot.
Yeah.
Oh, clever.
Yeah.
So it imparts a little flavor to it, and it's very different.
It's very different. It's really...
So we'll put a link so you guys can't get that material probably without ordering it. But hey, do it and then tell us about the rest of this.
Yeah. Maincraftdistilling.com.
Yeah.
It's where you go. This drink is called the 1400. They made it up. It's 2 ounces of Chisungkook, 1 ounce of fresh lemon juice, 1/2 ounce of honey simple syrup. We actually did the main thing.
And, yeah.
And we've got maple syrup in it instead.
Right. So we should call this the 1400 something.
And one.
And one.
1402 or?
Yeah, 1401.
Okay.
You talk to your buddies.
1/2 ounce of Aperol. We're using Campari instead. This I actually just found out today, Chris. I knew they were really similar. The only difference between Aperol and Campari is that it's got less alcohol, which is no good.
Right, so we went with the Campari.
Right, why would we do that?
There's probably a reason, but...
They smell very similar. Yeah. The Aperol's a little less bitter.
Yeah.
But I like the bitter.
And then we've got a lemon wedge.
And that's it.
And cheers. There you go. Cheers. Here we go.
It's a beautiful drink.
It is.
Kind of this Cosmo-looking...
Yeah.
Pinky thing, and very tasty and really unique, really summery.
Summery, which is great. Anything with Campari in it turns it into a summer drink. Mm-hmm. So, well, mostly. All right, you ready to do this?
Let's do this.
Okay, foundations, man.
So what are the basic goals? We're talking about a foundation. What does a foundation do? Okay, it holds up a building.
Exactly.
Duh.
Well, that's the biggest thing. Well, and it's more than duh. Mm-hmm. If there was any engineers listening, they're going to say, yeah, you got to think of it more as... It's more than vertical load. Mm-hmm. There's horizontal load. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if you're in, you know, California or something like that, or, you know, there's seismic loads and that sort of thing you have to worry about. But
and then there's frost heave.
Frost heaves for us.
It's so huge,
Oh, yeah.
You got to go deep enough.
It will split a building in half. Mm-hmm. No kidding. Those forces are not to be reckoned with. You don't have enough steel in your house to handle that.
It could rip your face off.
It could rip your face off.
Climate zone 22.
Oh my god.
People have been killed.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You don't
by frosty.
if you ever have like a 30-foot long wall, you know, foundation wall, and mm-hmm. and you just have Joe Schmo builder, you know, put an 8-inch wall in here, you're gonna have cracks like crazy. You need some engineering or some sort of thing. So, but we'll get into that. The other thing, Phil...
Keeps the water out.
Exactly.
Right?
How often is the biggest complaint about basement is wet?
Mm-hmm.
Or it smells wet. Right. Or it's you know, something.
Right.
It has to do with wetness.
Right. Damn. I should say it should keep the water out, right?
But exactly.
It often doesn't.
Exactly.
You know, and often I say the only way to avoid a wet basement in Maine is not to have a basement.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, and I've actually said that a couple times. I haven't really given you the credit for that one. But I've said it in meetings, and if they listen to the podcast, but they don't. They might. Who knows? But my clever clients listen to this podcast. You know, the good ones, the really good ones, listen to this podcast, and they
well
still
played.
Well, yeah, and they still like me too. Like I never know whether to refer a client to our podcast.
I know when they say, "Oh, we heard your podcast too."
Okay, and
you're still here. In my door.
Yeah, yeah, so that's
the door, so that's good.
So you must like alcohol like me and music. So yeah. Not for everybody, but anyway. So the other thing is, Phil, you gotta keep out the water, but you also, this is an opportunity to insulate. I mean, like we were joking about earlier, that basements are not that well insulated because people think it's just a basement, I'm not gonna be down there, whatever. But still, you know, where your house leaks, you know, tons of energy out to the ground if you're not, insulating it. So here's your opportunity, folks, to insulate your house where you meet the ground.
And again, as Chris said, there's people out there not insulating still. The 2012 IRC requires basement insulation now in climate zones 3 or higher.
That's right.
It's coming.
Right.
And I'm afraid that there's a number of builders out there who don't know that. Now, climate zones 3, you've got R5. If you're climate zone 4, it's an R10. And if you're in 5, 6, 7, and 8, you've got an R15. An R15, Chris.
Yeah, dude.
You know, the builders now who think they're doing a good job will put 2 inches of XPS on it.
Yeah, guess what? You didn't make it.
You didn't make it.
Right.
Don't be so proud, buddy.
Yeah, they think...
You failed.
Yeah, they're like, I insulated the basement. Enough, did you?
Yeah, but 2 inches, I doubled it up.
Yeah.
It's not enough.
Still not enough. You still failed. F. Not even F minus you got.
You do that?
Yeah, you think you're doing great. F minus, yeah.
Failed on your next house, too.
Exactly, yeah. Well, and we should also say it's not just builders. It's code enforcement officers, mm-hmm. too. So, and, of course, we're saying that's 2012. There's a big difference between 2009 and 2012 IRC.
But you know what doesn't change in the new decade, in the new millennium? The good old boys network.
That's right.
All right, there's guys who've been working with the same builders for years and years. And
yeah.
Hey, don't worry about it. I know the codes have changed, and
I've been building like this for years.
And the CEOs say the same thing. They turn the other way. So empower yourself, people.
Yeah.
Do a little research and know that this has to happen.
Let's
at least in R15.
Yeah.
In climate zones 5 and up.
Yeah, which we are, again, everyone knows this, Phil and I, we're used to the cold climate stuff. We're idiots when it comes to air conditioning. Meh, kind of.
Yeah.
We're not, you know, there's probably more clever people out there.
Right.
A couple. Yeah, so, and then one other thing that I always like to throw in about what your foundation really is doing is, you know, radon. Radon mitigation. Here in Maine, radon's a real, you know, real issue. It's a real deal here. You can't do a house without either a passive or active radon mitigation system. So,
right.
You know, maybe this is our, you know, public service announcement for radon gas. It can, you know, cause brain cancer and other...
Be bad things.
Yeah, do bad things.
Say radon, the termites of the north.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, they're coming.
I have a t-shirt that says that.
Do you really?
Yeah, no.
Oh.
I will.
Yeah, well, yeah, we will. We'll start... Yeah, guys, yeah, we've... Oh, yeah, wait till the next podcast. We have... We're gonna have to make t-shirts. Maybe we'll have a t-shirt contest. You know, open it up for designs. Yeah, kids will be like... See, I think that would work with, like, marketing students. It would not work with architecture students because they'd be like, the last thing I have time to do is design a stupid t-shirt for a stupid podcast that I like. I have a deadline.
Are we going to have a wet t-shirt contest and then...
Our wives would love it.
Make sure it dries out to the inside.
You
could test the perm rating of your t-shirt.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Harry, my business partner, would be thrilled to do the testing for that. I just got him in trouble.
I'm not so sure.
All right. I don't think his wife listens to this podcast either, so I think we're safe. But moving on, people. So, all right. What do you want to start with first?
Why don't we talk about slabs?
All right.
Let's sort of start from the
slab on
the bottom.
Right, exactly. Now, back to the basement slab conversation. I mean, and I think we've mentioned this before in our podcast that you know, it's becoming more and more common to have no basement for me. I don't know. Are you finding that, Phil? You're finding that you're doing a lot more slab on grade?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely are, you know, and I think we've talked about this before, but, you know, the building site has almost everything to do with that.
That's right.
If you got a sloping site,
yeah,
then you're not going to do it.
Right.
It's just you're bringing in too much fill and it doesn't make sense and there are other ways to figure it out. but otherwise,
yeah,
it's a really great solution.
Yeah, and the client also, the owner, homeowner also has a lot of input because they might be like, well, I have a workshop. You know, like the passive house, the last passive house I did, that happened. I mean, you know, normally you don't see basements in passive houses.
Right.
Houses. In fact, I wonder if this is the only passive house that has a basement. That would be very interesting. I haven't looked into that, so maybe I'm just now thinking of that.
Yeah, somebody chime in. I'm sure there's one out there.
Yeah. But that doesn't happen often. That's because that's a space you have to heat. And, you know, you just increased your volume. And as I remember Pat Kuhn said in our, you know, he said basement is the cheapest space you never use, you know. and if that's a basement to you, then I think you're better off without it. I mean, I've sat down with clients and said, all right, basements, why do you need one? If they say, well, I need to put my utilities in it. And you say, all right, well, what if your utilities were just, you know, small enough to fit inside that closet? I point to my closet over here that, you know, houses my material storage or whatever, you know, just a little closet. And they're like, well, okay, yeah, but I need to store stuff. And I say, well, what if for cheaper than your basement, I can give you some dry storage over your garage? Or, you know, that was the last,
right.
You know, and they're like, oh, yeah, I guess that would work. And then I guess we don't need a basement. No, probably not, if it's cheaper. I mean, that's the thing that brings it in. You know, it's like, well, if I can save you 10 grand by just not having a basement and not having to deal with it, don't you want that? And they're like, yeah, actually,
right.
Yeah. But if you had, but programmatically you need it, like workshop or something.
Then, right, then you deal with it. But I mean, really, it's probably the highest risk space in any house.
I would agree.
Wouldn't you say that?
Yeah, and the only thing that saves you is... No one puts their heirloom furniture down in the basement. Well,
is that a bad idea?
Well, it depends. If you know basements. It's like if you do basement right, I could blindfold you and take you down to the basement, and you'd go.
Right, one whiff.
Yeah. The normal basement, I can do that. Most houses in Maine, you'd smell it and you go, oh, you just brought me down to a basement. You can feel the air get cooler. Is that
plus, you walk downstairs. That was a clue.
Yeah, and they were creaky and they were just like, you know, yeah. Well, I know, we could have started on the second floor, third. I could have spun them around.
Chris, maybe it's just the dead bodies.
Yeah, it's the dead body smell. Yeah. You know you're in a basement. You know in Briley's basement when you smell the dead bodies. No.
So, and there's really two less joints. You move that slab up.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Two fewer joints.
Two fewer joints. Thank you.
For the grammarians out there, no need to email in. Fewer rather than less.
These guys only correct us if we have problems with our numbers.
Right. Yeah.
Carry them out to not enough.
That's right. We haven't got many grammar.
No, we haven't. Only my wife,
when we started the Green Architects Lounge, she's like, you know the apostrophe's in the wrong place, unless you're just doing this for one architect. And I'm like, I'll move that apostrophe. Boom. Yeah. And then, all right, moving on. So slabs. All right. So the basic thing that you have to deal with a slab when you're doing a slab on grade is you're doing it two ways, right, Phil? You have to beat the frost. We're going to pretend we're in a cold climate for this. You have to beat the frost, which means A, you dig down.
That's right.
Below the level at which the ground is going to freeze, because we know if that freezing happens underneath you, that water's going to expand and it's going to push your house up.
Right.
And you can't stop it. And it will,
pow. Right, so you got to get your footing below the frost line, whatever that is in your world. We've got 4 feet, 48 inches here in Maine.
Exactly. And just like there's people pouring on insulated basements, they're pouring on uninsulated frost walls, and they're, you know, pouring a slab on top. And they might be doing a couple of inches under the slab, but then they've got this real weak spot, which is where that frost wall is poking up out of the ground, and their slab is hitting it.
Right.
I mean, it's just concrete going to the outside.
Which is like an R nothing.
It is an R nothing, in fact. So a better way to... One of the things I've started doing in that scenario is I would pour the wall not against the concrete, but I'd pour it up against the framed wall. And it would be separated. And people, we're going to include some details. Click through some details here. We're going to do this as if you're driving in a car and you can't look at things on your computer. But we knew when we started this podcast that it's going to be really difficult to do without details. In fact, we've not done a bunch of podcasts. That's why we're late. We're just saying let's do wall sections. Oh no, details. They can't see them.
Sorry. Right.
But anyway. Check out these details that we're going to post, but I'm sure in one of them you're going to see that one trick that you can do is to actually lift the slab up above the frost wall itself, so that your insulation can actually go underneath the slab and then turn up against the framing.
That's right.
And use that as your pour stop. And look what you've done. You've isolated your slab. Go ahead, let that frost wall get saturated with water. Well, not, don't do that, but you know, let it get cold and damp, because you're completely above it. As long as you get in that capillary break, Phil, to keep that wall dry, that sill plate dry, and then you're fine, right as rain.
I think the isolation of that slab is so important. It's something that we're doing across the board. I sort of think we can't not do that now.
Right.
You know, one of the things that even when people started insulating below slabs, they made a mistake of not insulating the edge of the slab.
Right.
Doesn't seem like it's that much when you have this surface area. But I should have researched this stat, but it was something like 20% of your heat loss of your slab comes out the edge if that's uninsulated.
20% of the heat loss of your slab, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
and it makes sense. I mean, it's all the way around the edge there, so.
Yeah, it's a big area.
Yeah. So, another way, so either you're going down,
right.
If you're going down, you have to protect the slab itself, and you're kind of forgetting that you're trying not to insulate the wall itself, because who cares?
That's right. It's going all the way down, and
I've seen
it's
some.
It's really not about the insulation piece. It's just about the structure piece.
Right, and I've seen some weird things where some weird details where they'll insulate on the outside of the foundation wall. They'll insulate under the slab, but then the slab pours right up against the foundation wall, or maybe there's just 3/4 of an inch or something like that. And it just kind of seems silly because that the foundation wall is bitter cold, and
it's a serious thermal bridge, and it comes all the way into here.
Right, and it'll be there all year long.
So what's the other way, Chris?
The other way is it's called a frost protected slab, as you know. And what you're doing instead of digging down is you are warming the earth outwardly, or basically, you know, the earth is hot down there, you know, really hot, in fact. But by the time it gets to us, it's it's only like 50. If you dig down about 6 feet, it's 50. Well, that's what I'm. Dig down about 15 feet, it's about 50 degrees below us, even no matter how cold it is outside, or no, how warm it is outside. And so what you're trying to do is you basically put a skirt of insulation around the outside of your foundation wall, and a good rule of thumb is for every foot out that you insulate is about equivalent to a foot down.
Right, so we end up doing about a 4 foot skirt typically if we're going 4 feet down.
Exactly.
So you're keeping that 50 degree air warming the space below your slab.
That's right. Foundation. That's right.
So that frost doesn't get underneath.
Right. Yeah. So what's happening is that frost, it's 4 feet deep, and then it starts to hit your insulation, and then the heat of the earth is pushing back up, and by the time it reaches your building, it's no longer, you know, cold enough to freeze. So
that's right. So we're essentially taking that 50 degree mark, that was typically 4 feet below, and inching that upwards.
Yeah. At your foundation. Of course, that works way better if you're actually heating your house too. So but if you have a house that you're leaving, then you have to be, you know, leaving unattended, like a summer cottage or something like that. Mm-hmm. Then you have to be careful about this, because then you'll need even more insulation, because your house even above the slab is right. Bitter cold.
That's
too,
right. So. And by the way, on the side, if you have a house like that, expect it to be cold for the first couple days you get back.
Oh,
it takes a long time to warm up that slab.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the tricks that you've seen, you know, lately, and I've done this, is that you can actually, and we'll post some details, you can actually order some custom foam insulation, which sounds ridiculously expensive, but in fact it's surprisingly inexpensive
if you find the right people who do it.
That's right. And
you have to find somebody who does it without thinking.
Right.
People have to think it costs you money.
Exactly. But like we used a Branch River out of Massachusetts, and basically, you know, I can send them a CAD file, because they're used to doing SIPs, they do, and you know, foam whatever, and they do foam packaging. So a lot of times there's custom packaging. I'm going to ship a weird funny satellite dish or whatever, and I need to make sure it's protected while mailing, so I send them a CAD file for what I want that foam shape to have. So they basically make it to a custom shape. So you can build a shape that forms the slab. Check out our frost-protected slab detail that we have out there, and you see what we mean. You can get these interlocking foam shapes, and you can form a base for which you can pour a slab on it. And then it
takes away some of the thinking. Somebody's done that for you. Because, I mean, one of the questions that comes up in my mind, Chris, while you're talking is, why not do this every time, every building? Why don't people do frost-protected slabs across the board? And so one thing is that it's new.
Yes.
And they have to think about it.
Right.
And then the builder has to think about it, and the designer has to think about it, and you feel a little uneasy about doing it because it's the foundation, and don't screw up the foundation, dummy.
Right.
Let's just relax and do it the way we've always done it and move on. So it feels like a risk.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have heard it saves money for people who've done it again and again. You don't have to excavate as deep.
That's right.
So and you use less concrete.
You do, because concrete and steel in the spectrum of materials that you can use for your building, that's pretty expensive. They are among the most expensive materials. So basically, you're using more foam, which we like as green architects, not because of the material, but because of the energy you save. Using more foam, less concrete, less steel. Sometimes, though, I'll throw this out there that let's talk about curing slabs.
All right. One more reason to throw in here. Why not to do a frost-protected slab?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah.
And I ran into this once where we were unsure about the soils. So we got a geotechnical engineer out there.
Yeah.
And the soils weren't appropriate for it. It was clay, and there was something about the composition of clay that he said, this is just going to be really bad news.
Interesting.
So there's a risk if the soil's bad.
So you were worried about the hydrology underneath.
That's correct.
As in, if you can create this perimeter where you've got, basically, you make this little concrete bathtub with your frost wall that you can control the moisture, and you're not going to have moisture expansion.
Dude, when I say floating slab, I mean floating slab.
Yeah, that's right.
So that was the concern. He said, "Not here, friend."
Interesting.
So,
Yeah, and one technique, though, is to have a really thick slab when you do that.
Right, the monolithic pour.
A monolithic pour. And that is so you don't have to do control joints everywhere. But friends, let me tell you from experience and just from, anecdotal stories from others, get a guy who's done those before, who's done, you know, more than your 4-inch slab, you know, because what's happening...
And I usually think of them as, like, 18 inches. Does that sound crazy, Chris?
That's crazy. Foot? The slab?
Yeah, monolithic pours.
Yeah, I think foot... I think a foot between...
I've never done one. I've never...
Oh, really? I've done 10-inch slab. I just did 10-inch slab. We're about to do an 8-inch slab. And the 10-inch slab was for other reasons, but... which are too complicated to get into now, but... no, we're about to do an 8-inch slab, but when you do that... you can span much greater distances without control joints, but now your concrete's going to cure differently. Maybe we should talk about that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've had this debate, in times past about where the vapor barrier goes. You should have a vapor barrier, right, under your slab. If you're right up against the concrete, that's where I was always taught to pour it, because... in the old days, think about the 80s, 90s even, maybe even today, you know, there's some commercial projects where they put down they got gravel base or something like that, a vapor barrier, and then they do the sand layer. Why do they just do the sand layer? So they can level that out. They got a great base. Mm-hmm. They can walk on it. They can set up chairs. They can do all this stuff for, you know, wire rear reinforcement. Chairs are the little plastic things that hold up the...
Oh, I thought I pictured the workers hanging out.
Having chairs.
Having a beer.
No.
Sunning themselves midday.
Exactly. Well, I got to clarify for the students, you know, and chairs. Those little plastic things that hold up the reinforcement. Yeah. So the concrete flows around it, chairs. Anyway, that if you've got this little sand layer, that's a layer in which water can get in there and can pond. If you can have ponding water underneath your slab, then that's a point at which the slab will cure unevenly, which will cause curling. And that curling slab can be not so big a deal, or can be kind of a big deal. It can hump, or if it's an edge, it can, and that's where the curling comes from, it can kind of lift and create weird, you know, things. And if you saw cut the slab, so, you know, something, students, hey, here's another thing, concrete does not dry, it cures. It uses that water to turn itself back into a stone, which, you know, it's man-made rock that we've stripped it and pulverized it and all that jazz, and now we're putting it back together just by adding water. Poof. Really amazing, actually. But
cool.
Yeah, it is cool. But you want to make it so it cures evenly. So that's my reasoning for always trying to put the vapor barrier right up against the concrete pour. So, and there's our buddies Geologic. They do it differently, where they, in fact, that's a... I'll try to get their detail on here, but
yeah, see if we can get Alan and Matt to float us
in. Because they've really done some great stuff.
Yeah, they're doing some really interesting foundations,
and they do it without going to Branch River, going to some custom foam supplier.
They're all DIY, and they're making their own sips too, don't they?
Oh, I don't know.
I think so.
I don't know. That's fun.
Yeah.
But they, they extend, you know, sheet goods of slat of foam, and then they, you know, form an edge. And then they create a haunched slab, you know, for the wall, you know, to take the weight of the wall. And then they're like, well, we don't need an 8-inch slab or a 12-inch slab. It can go back to 4-inch. So they fill that middle area with crushed stone and then pour on top of that. And so, like, the vapor barrier, there's that cavity there that makes me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But they're fine with it, and off they go. So maybe I'll email them and we'll give an update or something.
So one of the other conversations and things that we still see changing, moving, even though I think we're pretty consistent how we do it, is where that vapor barrier is. Which goes first, the insulation or the vapor barrier below the slab?
Well,
it depends on, you know, if you... Right now, what we're doing is we're putting the insulation down, and then we're putting the vapor barrier, as Chris said, right underneath the slab.
That's my preferred way.
Right, but we've seen it the other way.
Yeah.
More often than not. In fact, we were on a job site 2 weeks ago. Even though we had it drawn properly, we were out there at the time when the guys were prepping for that slab.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't, of course, they didn't look at our drawings.
No,
and of course
they looked at them a week ago. So
the builder, who's a really good builder, and he's built with us before, and he's done it the right way before.
Yeah,
still had to stop and think. He wasn't quite sure. The guy said, "Listen, back off, man. We got to get in here and go. Trust us. This is how you do it. Just relax.
Right.
And we actually said, stop.
Good for you.
Can't do it that way. And they were a little pissed off first. And then we talked it through with them. And they said, oh, all right, that's fine. We'll pick up what we did. And they redid it. And they put their insulation down the proper way.
Good for you,
they
Phil.
They put the wrap on top of it.
Because I know that I've been in situations like that's a difficult position where things have been installed. There's precedent to where it's okay this way. And you have to go in there and stick to your guns and say, hey, dude, I didn't draw this thing. Client didn't hire me to draw this thing and tell you how it should be done for you to go out there and just wing it.
Yeah, and these guys...
Or do it your own way.
And these poor guys are just, you know, they're paid to get out there and do this job as fast as they possibly can and move on to the next one. They lose money and they don't really care.
You know, no.
It's not fair for them to do it.
Right.
But they were really great sports and they moved it around. And one of the things that we're starting to do with our drawings, we're actually showing pictures of this in the drawings.
Yeah.
Right next to the slab detail. So you can see how this slab sits on top, and then the vapor barrier sits on top of the insulation, and all the seams are taped with a particular kind of tape.
Right.
And once you get that visual, these guys get it a little quicker.
Right.
You can tape around all the penetrations and things like that.
Right. And you know, the truth is they're probably right. It probably would be fine, probably. But, you know, that's like you're rolling the dice there a little bit.
Right. So. Right. Right.
So
and it's, you know, it's hard to discover problems.
Right. And why
for long times.
Why roll the dice if you can, you know, keep those dice in your pocket and not roll them and detail it right. So
that's right. Anything else we need to say about slabs, Chris?
Well, I'm probably there's tons to say, but do people want to sit here and listen to them? I think they'll just click on the details and go, oh yeah, oh cool, and then we'll get tons of emails and all that. Because I know, yeah. No, let's call it good with slabs. In fact, let's call this part one. Let's freshen up these delicious drinks.
Let's do that.
And then we'll come back with a part two, and we'll talk about basements and crawl space. Evil crawl spaces. Sound good?
Boo.
Boo.
Cheers, Chris.
Cheers, buddy.
That's it for this part of the episode. Be sure to tune in next week for more from the Green Architects Lounge podcast. A quick reminder that our theme music is Zelda's theme from Perez Prado, and that the views and drinking habits of the hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Green Building Advisor. Thanks for tuning in, everyone, and keep up the good work.